on session, Judge Conley, Judge Werke, Judge Bradfield, the Honorable Francis J. Conley presiding.
Thank you, let's all be seated. All right, good morning. Our first case this morning is A23-0126, the State of Minnesota versus Dante White. As all parties are aware, the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief, respondent will have 15 minutes, and finally the appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Whenever you're ready, just approach the microphone, adjust it to your level, and tell us who you are in a loud, clear voice, please.
May it please the court, my name is Christopher Mishek and I represent appellant Dante White. Mr. White was convicted of murder for the death of KB. At issue in this case is nearly $16,000 in restitution. Before I get into the heart of my argument, I want to, in the interest of candor, alert the court to some statutes that I came across in preparing for the argument. 611A, 52, 53, and 54 deal with the Crime Victims Reparation Board. And one of the statutes defines a collateral source, which is what the crime board must subtract from a claimed loss. And it goes through a list of things like workers' compensation, wage continuation programs, things that the crime board must subtract. At the end of it, it says this term does not include a life insurance contract. This didn't come up in briefing or below at the court, the district court.
Don't worry about it.
Yeah, this may be an issue that maybe supplemental briefing if the court thinks it applies. But to get to the heart of my argument, the court should reverse the district court's restitution order here for really two reasons. The victim's family's aggregate loss here was zero because they received the life insurance proceeds that were caused by the defendant's conduct. And the court really erred in refusing to account for those. The second reason is that even if this court disagrees with the life insurance issue, there's a number of items that are just not reasonable restitution items because they occurred long after the initial funeral and reception, and we're also challenging those.
Counsel, I'd like you to talk about the issue raised by respondent in the state's brief, which deals with whether appellant's claim is timely and properly before the court. I recognize that in your reply, you argued that the parties waived the timelines, and I know you're familiar with what they are, so I'm not going to try to repeat them. My trouble with your argument is that it relies heavily on the supplemental record, the emails, and I can't see where the parties agreed to waive the timeline. So maybe you want to be more specific, if you can be, now.
Sure, yeah. Judge, and you know, I was informed by the state that they are withdrawing that part of their argument. However, I'm happy to answer the questions of the court on it. I do think that the times were waived in the sense that they were both discussing, you know, when a hearing should be scheduled, and they were negotiating in good faith about a resolution. I think the emails show that the counsel below immediately alerted the court and the opposing counsel that they were challenging restitution. And
yeah, I'm confused, so I need to stop you. We understand all the sequence of what happens right in the emails. This would be for respondent counsel, but are you saying that that issue isn't before us any longer, that there's been some resolution? I must have missed something. I did get your supplemental authority, but
right,
I didn't see anything about it.
My understanding, talking to the state, and I said in my affidavit to the court when I asked to supplement the record, was that the state was going to waive the issue and not move forward
with
the issue.
I missed that. I read your supplemental authority in the case that supports it, which also stands very prominently for the proposition that you've got 30 days to make your time. I know that wasn't the issue with the case that you submitted. Okay, all right. Understood.
So we'll certainly quiz the respondent about that.
I just, before we let go completely, counsel, because, you know, as though, although you have presented this as the parties agreed to suspend the timelines, and the parties have not discussed this as a matter of appellate jurisdiction. This is a statutory remedy, which has pretty strong language. As I said, I know you're familiar with it. A defendant may not challenge restitution after the 30-day time period has passed. So, and it defines what a challenge is, and that has to be filed with the court. So nothing like that happened here. Yeah, I've read the emails. I get it. But the emails don't say that Mr. White was excused from this statutory requirement. And even if it did say it, if this is a jurisdictional requirement, this is something the court has to consider. So do you want to comment on that? Or
The comment I have is that, you know, it's not necessarily a jurisdictional issue if everyone's agreeing to have a hearing. And, you know, the case I point to the court to is State v. Zastro, where it was a different factual circumstance, but the court, in an unpublished decision, determined that the parties had waived by their behavior. And I think that's applicable here. There are other circumstances where there's timelines in statutes, I think the post-conviction statute as well, where things can be waived if they aren't waived.
There's specific analysis from our Supreme Court, though, on why that's not jurisdictional, and it goes back to the fact that post-conviction relief was available at common law. I don't think that's true of restitution in the criminal context. Yes, there's an equitable restitution, a contractual restitution, but not in the criminal context except as a result of these statutes that we're talking about.
Right, and the only thing I'll say is that the cases cited by the respondent, the cases where this court clearly says it's been waived, the main factual difference is there wasn't a hearing in those cases. The parties didn't sit down and actually have a full hearing, and nothing was really done below to challenge it. And the cases I think they cited, Mason, Bell, and Miles, in each one, you know, there were objections.
I track your analysis of those cases. Okay. They're quite different from this one. But if it's a jurisdictional issue, if it is, and I'm not suggesting I've made any decision about that or any preliminary thought on it, but if it is a jurisdictional issue, it's not something the parties can waive, right? Subject matter jurisdiction, appellate jurisdiction can't be waived by the parties.
I think you're right about that analysis. I can't say that if you determine that it's a jurisdictional issue, the court didn't have jurisdiction. I think at that point, then I would have to make a different argument about counsel below and their, effectiveness. I think that's probably where it would go.
Is that something that you would want to submit supplemental briefing on?
I would, if that really is where the court is headed with this, I would. I think that it would give Mr. White an opportunity to then also preserve the record about effectiveness, because if really it's a jurisdictional issue and something absolutely needed to be filed within that 30 days, then it's an ineffective assistance of counsel, and I'd like to preserve that.
Okay.
Do you want to shift, did I pronounce it right? Is it Mr. Mishick?
Mishick, yeah.
Mr. Mishick, do you want to then shift to either the two other arguments, that they got money, which could have paid for the funeral, and then I think you had some specific challenges to some items.
Right. Shifting to the merits, in the life insurance issue, the two phrases I'd guide the court to in the restitution statute that support our argument are the phrases amount of economic loss and then out-of-pocket losses. The amount of economic losses, the Supreme Court recently last year determined that means district courts need to account for income that a victim receives because of the defendant's conduct.
Right, and that's the current case.
That's the current case. And
so
I do think it's
what,
not a...
What economic benefits did your client give the victim when he killed him?
So I think...
I didn't really see that.
Well,
and I saw that was the heart of Kern, which is... Okay, he did steal $1 million from Medicaid fraud, but by God, I did treat some of these people. So I don't see Curran getting you where you want to be, in my opinion only.
Right, and I mean, I disagree. I think Curran is a broader holding within the first issue, and it deals with just accounting in general and how that happens during restitution. And essentially, you know, I'm not saying that Curran factually is exactly like this case, but the actions of the defendant, you know, caused the life insurance policy to flow. The Curran case looked at Botcher in determining.
Do you really want to go there? You think there? I have $1 million life insurance. I'm going to go with the fact that my wife and three children would not be thrilled to get that money if it meant someone killed me. And I'm not so sure that's. So we would issue an opinion that said the amount of economic benefit includes life insurance, which the only way the victim's family could have gotten it is by being murdered. So that's a good thing. I mean, I don't think I would support that.
Judge, I'm not saying it's a good thing or a bad thing. It's an accounting thing, and that's what restitution's about. And the
fair enough, but I mean,
you know,
if this was, you know, somebody blew up the car, okay, and I've got auto's insurance that deals with cars being blown up, I think it's a fair comment that there should be a setup for that, because, you know, my car blew up, I got money to replace that, why should I have the double benefit? Life insurance, I think, is a little different. Life insurance is income replacement. And here, I don't think it's particularly, again, only me talking, I don't think it's particularly fair for your client to get a benefit of income replacement insurance, which is supposed to replace income, and then they should use some of that to pay for the funeral. It seems to me they should use it all for the income replacement. You know, the guy's dead, no wages coming in, and there should not be a deduct to pay for the funeral, even though they did use the money to pay for the funeral. Well, I mean, I assume they did, I don't know. So why am I wrong on that, Mr. Mishick?
Well, I think you're wrong because the record doesn't support that. The family here said that they used the money for the funeral, and there was really nothing in the record that the family testified to that, you know, oh, this life insurance policy was meant to pay, you know, perhaps pay off the house or pay for college or have supplemental income. The district court here determined that one of the purposes of life insurance is to pay for final expenses and funeral costs. It said in its order that it was going to presume that it had another benefit that the family, that was its primary purpose. Well, the primary purpose also could have been to pay for final expenses that included funeral costs.
Well, I mean, we don't have the policy. You're right. We don't have the policy in the record. And there are some policies you can buy which are just, you know, very small and are specifically designed to pay for a funeral. Then there's, you know, $1 million life insurance policy. And I mean, I don't know, unless the casket is made of solid gold, I'm going to go with it's mostly for income replacement. So maybe do you want to move on to the specific items you didn't like?
Sure.
Let me ask you a question about that, and you're kind of getting down on your time. You know, the way I read this, you're challenging I don't even want to call it grandeur, but the way the funeral was orchestrated, that there was boats and T-shirts and buttons and so on. But, you know, at what point do we don't look at this de novo, right? We're looking at this for an abuse of discretion. Isn't that the standard?
I do think, and I did cite the de novo in my briefing, but I do think it is an abuse of discretion looking at the cases, especially.
The judge in this case, though, said that the costs were not excessive but proportional to the expected service. And I just don't want this court or other courts to start measuring, you know, how fancy of a service do you have? Are you going to have coffee only? You're going to have ham sandwiches with it.
And I'm not asking the court to do that. What my point is that there was a funeral and there was a reception, and we're not challenging anything to do with the initial funeral and reception. What we're saying is that under Botcher, and really the case that I cited in my supplemental letter that came out last month, Cloutier, that these aren't reasonable costs because they happen, first of all, temporally, well after the funeral. You know, this is a barbecue that happened a month after the funeral, and then there was in the summertime a boat party that was catered, and then there was jewelry in that happened, and then there was masks and other things, and it kept going. At a certain point, these aren't things that are directly related to the crime. They don't result in the crime, from the crime. They may, you know, pass the but-for test, but the Supreme Court in Botcher was very clear that this isn't a but-for analysis. This is a more of a proximate cause. Was it directly caused by the offense? And our point in this argument isn't to ask the court to get involved in the nitty-gritty of funeral planning. That is not what we're asking for. What we're simply saying is that the court abuses discretion here because the law under Botcher requires this directness between the crime and the actual expenses. And there needs to be a cutoff at some point. That's what the legislature meant by the word, directly caused. I see my time's running out. If there are any other questions.
You will have time for rebuttal. Thank you very much, counsel. We'll now hear from counsel for respondent, please.
May it please the court, counsel. I'm Assistant Hennepin County Attorney Adam Petras, and I represent the respondent in this matter, the state of Minnesota. Judge Bradfield, going directly to the issue that you raised with Mr. Mishek, as a threshold matter, I just want to be clear that the state is abandoning the argument it made under the first issue of the brief that I filed. Had I known about those emails, had I known they existed and what was discussed in those emails with Judge Quam's chambers, I would not have advanced the procedural and timing requirements argument. All three members of this panel served as district court judges before joining this court, and two of you were judges back on the Hennepin County bench before joining this court. And as you're probably aware, sometimes...
Hell ever since. We
sometimes in Hennepin County, the practice and loose procedure, if I can use that phrase, strays from the rules and the statutory requirements. And those emails show why that happened in this particular case. So in light of those emails that I agreed can be included in the record, I am not going to stand here and make the same argument to you that I made in my brief. I feel that would be disingenuous. However, I understand the questions and the discussion that were happening before that this court must decide this case in accordance with the law, as it decides all cases in accordance with the law. And the state simply is not going to be taking a position on that threshold issue that I did include in my brief originally before I saw those emails.
Well, so counsel, I just need you to be a little bit more specific. You're now agreeing with the appellant that the parties waived the timelines under the statute?
I understand the issue that you raised with Mr. Mishek, Judge Bradfield, about the subject matter jurisdiction. I have briefed before the Supreme Court in Kingbird in the last 2 years the jurisdictional nature of the post-conviction statute. So I'm aware of that issue and how that cannot be waived. I'm merely saying that I think it was waived on the basis of these emails to the extent that I would not have included that first issue in my brief, raising the issue myself as the state, because Mr. Mishek had not raised that in his briefing to this court. I would not have raised that issue had I saw those emails and the communication that involved attorneys from my office. Is that precise enough, or can I try to go a little further?
I'm curious, and you can certainly decline. Are you going to comment on whether this court has jurisdiction over the issue that's been raised on appeal?
I'm going to take no position on that.
Okay. So you have no interest in supplemental briefing on whether this court has jurisdiction?
I am happy to participate in supplemental briefing. What I will say is that I'm taking no position because I understand the test from Carlton, which is a 2012 Minnesota Supreme Court decision that went through the subject matter jurisdictional nature of the post-conviction statute. I understand the different elements that are analyzed, and I have not spent the time until this very moment to apply those to the restitution statute. So anything I would offer right now would simply be ill-prepared. I could probably put something a little bit more intelligent together in a supplemental brief.
Okay. Thank you.
Turning to the life insurance claim, appellant is arguing that if there is enough insurance to cover a loss, then it cannot be considered out of pocket under the restitution statute. Essentially, that restitution can only start when insurance money runs out. So appellant is effectively asking this court to determine the monetary value of a murder victim's life after funeral expenses, which this court, it should go without saying, should be loath to do. KB, the victim in the murder case, chose to have a life insurance policy. We don't know how much KB's family received after appellant murdered him. Let's say
it was... We don't know who owned the life insurance policy, right?
What was that?
We don't know who owned the life insurance policy. At best, correct. We simply know who the beneficiary was.
Correct. Yeah. It only came up in the record when the mother of the victim mentioned and referenced it in response to a question during the restitution hearing testimony. No attorneys, as far as I'm aware, involved in this case at the trial level were aware of its existence until that information was volunteered during testimony. But let's say that policy, regardless of who owned it, it was $50,000. So given the roughly roughly $15,000 in funeral expenses, that would mean that KB's life was worth, in out-of-pocket terms, $35,000. That apparently was the value of his life. $15,000 for the loss of funeral expenses and $35,000 for the loss of the loved one himself. But what happens if this court, or if the victim's family, believes that KB, as a family member, and all the highs and all the lows that he gave to this world, was worth that full $50,000? Then the $15,000 in funeral expenses truly was an out-of-pocket loss, since that $50,000 life insurance policy went to completely covering the $50,000 value in terms of income replacement, as Judge Connolly was mentioning before, or just in terms of the value of his life. This court, or any appellate court, shouldn't be, under the restitution statute, be in the business of determining the monetary value of how much a murdered life is worth. The potential inequities of that approach are obvious. The worth of a loved one's life depends on the existence or the size of a life insurance policy that had been taken out beforehand. That just is not the right place for this court to be.
Well, you know, I mean, I don't think Mr. Mishick is arguing that. I agree with your position. I don't think he's arguing that. What about this? Let's go to some of the specific numbers. What if 6 months after the funeral, let's say he's a veteran, the family decides, you know, Dad would have liked it if we all, let's say he's a Vietnam, well, no, let's just go with World War II. Let's just say he's a World War II victim, and the family says, you know, I think Dad would have liked it if we went to the World War II memorial, the whole family, and we put a wreath there. And therefore, and so they do, you know, hooray for Dad, he's a veteran. And then the family says, you know what? We want the airfare for the three of us who went. We want the hotels for the three of us who went to D.C. We had to eat, so we want the 3 days of meals when we went to D.C. And we want the Uber fares from the hotel to the World War II Memorial, where we did indeed put a wreath. You think that's okay? Is that a valid restitution amount? You know, is that within the statute?
I think a district court judge would have the discretion to decide whether or not that constituted a funeral expense.
Let's say the district court judge said, yep, that $20,000 is perfectly fine. Is that an abuse of discretion under the facts I've outlined?
Which are different from this case.
I didn't say it was the same case. But I'm trying to get a feel for, you know, there's got to be some limits. Well, do you think there are some limits on the amount of restitution?
There should be some outer bounds, some contours of what would be considered an abuse of discretion and reasonable. I don't believe those were reached in this particular case. Judge Connolly, in the hypothetical
you think they were reached in my hypothetical?
They far closer to it, yes.
Okay.
That would, as you know, speaking To borrow your wording when you were speaking with Mr. Mishek before, just speaking to me personally, if I was that trial prosecutor, I would have a hard time advancing that argument before a district court judge. I would not have had a hard time or nearly as hard of a time advancing the argument that the trial prosecutors did advance in this case for the itemized restitution or funeral expenses that were outlined in the second page of the addendum to my brief.
And counsel, if you don't mind, Judge Connolly, what's the difference between the World War II veteran and the family that goes, travels to D.C. and proceeds in that manner, as opposed to the challenge that we're now hearing from appellant related to the barbecue and the jewelry and the clothing? I mean, what's you're telling me that there's some principal difference that a prosecutor would discern between the two, and I'm just struggling to see what that is.
I apologize. I tried to ground it in my own personal perspective there. I think different prosecutors are different. I think it is a discretionary call. And as long as there are factual findings to support, there could be a judge out there that would have granted the restitution. I didn't hear exactly the dollar amounts. I didn't recall them from Judge Connolly's example.
15 grand.
If all that was only $15,000, then perhaps that was reasonable, and I will amend my previous answer. I think $15,000 is ultimately reasonable as a funeral expense for someone's life who was taken at such an early age. What I hear the issue kind of boiling down to, both from Mr. Court's questions as well as from Mr. Mishek, on that second issue, not the life insurance piece, mm-hmm. but just the reasonableness of Judge Quam's discretionary decision to grant restitution for those funeral expenses, is that does the restitution statute limit funeral expenses, as that term is used in the statutory text, to just a single funeral event, or is it possible that a single funeral event that must occur close enough in time into when the murder was committed? I mean, that is one view, and that was a view that was made to Judge Quam, but that was a view that he rejected in his findings and in his conclusions. And I don't believe it's a matter of law based on the restitution statute that a murder victim is only entitled, or murder victim's family, I should say, is only entitled to restitution for a single funeral, and that a district court would have no discretion over determining funeral expenses beyond that. There is nothing in the text of any provision of the restitution statute that supports that. If we want to turn to the dictionary here, Merriam-Webster defines the word funeral as observances in the plural. Webster's New World defines the word funeral as a sequence of rituals and ceremonies, plural. The American Heritage Dictionary defines the word funeral as a ceremony or group of ceremonies, plural. It is not limited to a single event that must temporarily occur within a certain number of weeks after the murder.
So if I can put words in your mouth.
Please do.
What you're saying then is that this is within the district court's sole discretion. If somebody wants to have flowers, they're a flower person. If somebody wants to have buttons and balloons, that's their prerogative, and the district court should be the decider of that.
I believe that is what controlling case law says. I think that the language from, say, Lindsay, which I cited in my brief, which was talking about a number of funeral expenses that were challenged, it says that those were reasonable. There was a soloist that was hired at that particular funeral. I've gone to many funerals where there's not been paid musical performers before, but that was reasonable, or at least it was not an abuse of discretion for the district court sitting as the fact finder to determine that that was appropriate in that particular case. The language from Palubicki talks about certain expenses not being too attenuated from the actual event. And I don't believe the individual expenses that were itemized, 1 through 26, in the Restitution Exhibit 1 were too attenuated. And I want to draw this court's attention back to something that Mr. Mishek raised before in 6 weeks ago when the Supreme Court issued that decision in Clodier, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. In the supplemental authority letter, Mr. Mishek highlighted that sentence in which it says, the state may struggle to prove that the cost of a diamond-encrusted gold casket, similar to the example Judge Connolly mentioned before, is the type of loss that should be included in a restitution order. That's at page number 221 in that decision. That's near the end of a paragraph. And the sentences immediately before that individual sentence read as follows. In fact, they read in a way that indicates that the expenses that are related to a funeral are directly caused by
the homicide offense, which is how I read appellant's argument challenging those expenses. This Supreme Court in March of this year wrote, determining whether a victim's loss is causally linked to a defendant's offense is not the same inquiry as determining whether a loss is properly compensated through restitution. For example, consider a defendant who is convicted of a homicide offense and ordered to pay restitution for the victim's funeral expenses. The cost of the funeral may consist of many individual expenses, all of which are losses the victim sustains as a result of the offense. And then Supreme Court goes on to say, for there would be no funeral but for the defendant's offense. It may, however, be the case that not all funeral expenses are appropriately compensated through restitution. And then it goes on to highlight the diamond, or give the diamond-encrusted gold casket example. Notably, the Minnesota Supreme Court, in its most recent decision discussing the statutory language of the restitution statute, embraced the but-for language, which obviously earlier decisions had criticized as the test. I say all this, and I see I only have a few seconds left at this point, to emphasize that what constitutes an appropriate funeral expense in terms of timing, how close it was in time to the murder, and to the nature of the cost, you know, for that soloist example, for instance, in Lindsay, that's a question of fact, which is why the Supreme Court applied the clearly erroneous standard, standard review to that issue in Lindsay, which is what I believe, as I put in my brief, is that the standard review that should apply in this situation. I am out of time. I'm happy to answer any additional questions, but if there are no further, I simply ask this court to affirm the restitution order.
Thank you. Counsel for the appellant, you'll have the last word, sir.
Thanks. Just a couple of things. But respondent keeps calling a lot of these items that we're talking about funeral expenses, and I disagree with that. You know, the funeral happened in the early May, and the reception happened the day after. And a lot of these expenses were months after that occurred. And, you know, some of them were jewelry and masks and T-shirts. And I just don't think that they are funeral expenses.
Help me with that. Why is the jewelry not a funeral expense?
Well, because it didn't happen during the funeral. It didn't happen around the time of the funeral, and it happened months afterwards.
It doesn't generally happen, so help me out there.
Well,
so
I mean, the purchasing of it, my understanding of the record is that the dates of purchase are after the funeral.
Okay, so help me out there. So yeah. You obviously think the funeral happened on a particular day. You're timing it to what, internment? The church service. I mean, you have some criteria that you're not really explaining, and I'm struggling because we are in an area where the district court does have some discretion, as again the supplemental authority that you gave us.
I agree that the court has discretion, but there needs to be some factual record of why these things were directly related.
What if it was like a charm bracelet with the victim's name on it?
Well, and that's I think what items like that. But they occurred months after the funeral. I think, you know, I don't have the exact dates, but they didn't occur during the funeral. I don't think they were worn during the funeral.
What if they were? What if they specifically got? What if they gave a charm bracelet? Mm-hmm. Mom, and the three. Well, I don't know how many children, but mom gets a jewelry bracelet, a charm bracelet made with the victim's name and the date of his murder, and asks the. And they all wear it, and she wants them all to wear it at the funeral.
And I think that? If there were testimony about that, saying, you know, we're not challenging the clothing items, for example, at the funeral. I think if there are... The clothing items at the funeral.
Sorry.
So there are a number of clothing items we're not challenging. I think, again, if they bought jewelry, and I think if there was testimony at a restitution hearing saying, this is how our family dealt with this, this is how we grieve, this is how we felt, you know, we got together and we all bought these, I think that would have probably been sufficient. The problem is, again, there is really no record of why these expenses were necessary or related to the offense. I point to the court to Tenorelli. That's the Hmong healing ceremony case. And There was extensive testimony in the record from a cultural anthropologist and from, I think, the PSI writer, saying why it was extremely necessary to have that ceremony after the defendant was assaulted, and that, you know, for Hmong culture, it was something that was needed to heal. There was a record, and it was made, and the court made a decision. Here, there's no discussion on the record. There's no discussion about why the boat party months after, you know, was something connected to the offense. What did it do to the family as far as the healing that was happening? And I think that, you know, perhaps some of these things could be presumed, but that's not how it works. The state has to prove this, at least by preponderance, at the hearing, and there was really no testimony about any of these items at all. And they were just rubber stamped. And so that I think that's one of our complaints. I don't have anything else unless the panel does.
No, thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Mishak. Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Petras. The matter is submitted.